The Department of Anthropology at the University of North Texas is a proud sponsor of the SFAA Podcasting Project. The department offers two master's programs in applied anthropology, an on-campus program and an online program. The online program is the first and only fully online master's in applied anthropology in the United States. More information can be found online at anthropology.unt.edu.
Very, very pleased to. This is now our fifth collaboration with SFAA in developing seminars and books. This began in the year 2000 with a collaboration that took place in Mérida, Mexico. The seminar was held in July of the year 2000, edited by Stan Hyland, came out in 2005. The next one was a seminar on globalization, water, and health, chaired by Linda Whiteford. We enjoyed having the plenary session in 2003 in Portland. Probably many of you were there. And that title, too, appeared in 2005, Globalization, Water, and Health, Resource Management in Times of Scarcity. Just last night, we launched our third collaborative book, Politics, Practice, and Theory. It was based on a seminar on looking at repatriation as a force of change in contemporary anthropology. That book came out this past year, 2008, entitled Opening Archaeology, Repatriation's Impact on Contemporary Research and Practice, edited by Tom Killian. And many of you may have been there last night. Finally, we had a seminar with a book in process right now that we hosted in October 2006, held the plenary at the SFAA's in Tampa, 2007, Global Health in the Times of Violence, co-chaired by Paul Farmer, Barbara Rilke-Bauer, and Linda Whiteford. And that is on the editorial calendar to appear, we hope, ideally, for the SFAA's next spring. It was in 2006 in Vancouver that I wandered into a session that was organized by Laura McNamara and was struck by just how urgent and important the topic of engaging scholars' engagement with military and national security sectors was. Laura then became the workhorse in pulling this very long and complicated process together. We had two short seminars around this topic, and now this is our plenary in honor of that work, and I'm going to turn it over now to Susan Andreotta to say a few words about the future of the collaboration.
Good evening, and thank you for being here. I'm Susan Andreotta. I'm the president of SFAA and quickly going out. My term ends on Friday. That's not why you came here. I'm just too excited. No, I wanted to share a little bit about the history with our relationship. It had been a little bit informal since 2000, and what we've done with the School of Advanced Research and the Society for Applied Anthropology is to formalize a relationship. And we've had a series of meetings between the two organizations. For about a year and a half now, we've been meeting at the applied meetings and the AAA meetings, and we figured out a structure that will work between our organizations. And what we'd like to do is invite all of you or any of you who have interested topics or know of others to put together a panel of ideas, or not of ideas, a plenary, something like you will see tonight. You'll be putting together a proposal with people, their names, and then the idea behind part of it would be the product of another book, okay? But this time, it's more formal in that between the two organizations, the leadership of SAR and the leadership from SFAA will be vetting the proposals, and we will pick among the ones that are submitted that would be useful for a plenary and useful for the production of a book. And useful is probably too strong a word here, but I hope you understand what I'm trying to imply. And then cutting edge is what we're kind of looking for, and taking us into new agendas. The next plenary will be 2011, and the applications are due September 15th, and there's a hot link for the SFAA on the SFAA webpage with more details on this, and it will take you to the SAR link as well, and they on their website they will have the application and more details on how to go about doing it. And I would encourage you to think about an 8-person panel and maybe thinking about 13, 14 people for a book. How many chapters? No, 10, sorry. Okay, and so that's where we're headed in the future. And the other idea is that it would alternate be every other year, not every year. You meet in July and plan out how this would be looking for the panel session. So give some thought. September's not too far off, but there's some meetings in between, and as we plan for AAA and as we plan for other meetings, there'll be great opportunities for us to have some really exciting proposals to look at and then making it very exciting to the next plenary. But tonight we're here to speak about scholars, security, and citizenship, and this will give us all an opportunity to learn from experts who've been researching on the military for some time. There are three parts to the plenary that address scholarship in a national context, and they look at engagement and risk, and looking at it from a around-the-world perspective. There'll be examples from the German armed forces, the Israeli military, counterinsurgency in Vietnam and Thailand, the concept of culture as it's taught in the U.S. military academies, ethics of engagement, issues of security, and other challenges. I think from this whole experience that we're going to learn a lot in a double panel. I know over the past year and a half, I have learned a tremendous amount. So I look forward to learning from our participants, and I would hope that there's enough time for some engaged discussion and that we keep going after that. And I believe there's a reception following. Okay, so if we can't get all the questions in after the panel, I hope that we can have more conversation over some nice refreshments. And I know it's a long night. I thank you for your patience, but I better stop and let us get going. Thank you.
All right. My name is Laura McNamara, and I am the chair for this plenary session this evening. I want to start off, first of all, by thanking SFAA and SAR for their kind sponsorship over the past couple of years of a number of discussions and engagements that we've had. I'm going to start off by giving you a bit of the background for this plenary session so you have some context. As James mentioned, it was a long time in the making. It actually has its roots in the SFAA meetings in Vancouver, British Columbia, and actually before that, the Inter-University Seminar and the Armed Forces and Society meetings in 2005 in Chicago. So this has been coming together for a long time. At the Vancouver meetings, we had a group of anthropologists from around the world who work in and around military and or national security institutions presenting on the topic, the moral epistemology of fieldwork in the defense community, in which we collectively discussed how ethics and practice intertwine in anthropology in all of our practice, and how this influences both individual decisions around careers in the military and defense institutions, as well as these larger disciplinary and public perceptions of the appropriateness of anthropologists working in or around national security / defense institutions. And I think what really made this panel interesting and unique for me, at least, was the fact that we had these discussions, and if you've been at the SFAAs or you've been in many places or any meetings over the past few years, these discussions have really heavily privileged the United States and academic politics in the United States. What we had in that panel was a group of anthropologists from several different countries who pointed out that national traditions in the relationship between the pen and the sword, if you will, differ in different parts of the world, and that shapes the way that anthropologists perceive their role vis-a-vis military institutions. Now, as James mentioned, SAR very generously offered to fund a couple of extensions of that panel, although there was a significant twist. James Brooks suggested strongly that we bring anthropologists in who actually study violence, namely Neil Whitehead and Brian Ferguson. Neil's not here this evening, but we've got Brian there, and you'll be hearing from him. Their SAR collaboration a while ago, I believe it was in the early 1990s, gave us War in the Tribal Zone. And with SAR sponsorship, there were a larger group of us that met in February of 2007 and then again in July of 2008. So again, this has been a long process and a lot of discussion to explore the ways in which changing relationships among anthropologists and institutions of power and the ways that anthropologists make sense of violence and conflict and the politics of anthropology as a discipline are emerging these days in this particular historical moment. We explored these from the perspectives of ourselves as scholars, as activists, As citizens in our democracies, we all come from democracies, and as anthropologists, and to look at how these different roles intersect in our work lives and in the kinds of commitments that we make professionally to our institutions and to our countries. And those papers are the basis of this panel today, which you're going to be hearing. Now, as many of you are probably aware, universities and other institutions have been cutting back significantly on travel funds. I don't know how many of you experienced that. But we actually are missing several of the people that were supposed that were part of the original discussion, and they haven't made it today, namely Neil Whitehead, Nasser Abu Farha, Maren Tomford, Anne Irwin, and Clementine Fujimura. At the same time, we have two people who agreed to join us, even though they were not part of the original discussions, and those people are Danny Hoffman and Doug Fry. And we also have two people who traveled a very long distance to be here, Doug Fry and Eyal Ben-Ari, Doug coming from Finland by way of, was it Michigan? He's doing this cross-country tour of the United, this anthropology tour of the United States. And then we've also got Eyal Ben-Ari came from Israel, from Jerusalem. So I want to thank them for making this very long journey. For me, it was just up the road because I'm down in Albuquerque. So, accordingly, what we've ended up doing, when we had originally organized the papers, there was a thematic flow to them. I've ended up changing the papers around. So if you were expecting the order on the program, you're going to be disappointed, and I'm sorry about that. But we wanted to move them around to have some thematic coherence and flow. And so in the first part of the panel, we're going to hear papers from scholars considering what it means for anthropology to contribute meaningfully to problems of security, violence, and conflict in the post-Cold War era. And then we're going to have a break before turning to the second part of the panel, which I think begins at 7:20 or 7:30, in which our presenters are going to be discussing challenges that engagements presents for anthropology as a whole, which are discourses I think we've all been involved in one shape or form or another. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and turn to the first part of this panel. And by this point, I think many of us are familiar with high-profile ups and downs of programs like the Human Terrain System or the Minerva effort. And if you're not, you will be, because Brian Ferguson's going to be speaking about those in the second half of this panel. In this set of papers, though, the panelists are actually working outside the headlines being HTS and Minerva and other initiatives, to discuss the manifold ways in which anthropology can and does engage problems of security, defense, militarism, conflict, and violence in the present. And the first paper comes from Anne Irwin, who is in Bangladesh at the moment and will not be teleconferencing in, so I'm going to go ahead and read her paper for her. And it's based on her fieldwork experience with the Canadian soldiers in Afghanistan and the encounter that she had with a journalist who was on the ground, an embedded journalist, and she's got some wonderful ethnographic moments in it, which you'll be hearing in just a minute. Then we'll hear from Eyal Ben-Ari, an Israeli anthropologist who's done extensive fieldwork on empirical investigations. Who's done extensive fieldwork among Israeli soldiers, and he's going to be arguing that omitting military institutions from empirical investigation really, in essence, undermines our authority to speak critically to problems of militarization and the projection of state force. Danny Hoffman, who kindly contributed a paper, is going to be drawing on his fieldwork in West Africa to describe how emerging forms of military organization, and specifically the privatization of warfare in the form of the subcontractor, demand the empirical attention and theoretical explanation that anthropologists can offer. And lastly, I'm going to be discussing the expanding interest in culture and the reconfiguration of the interrogation community in the United States under the global war on terror. Our papers are timed so that we have two sets of four papers with roughly 15 to 20 minutes per paper, and we'll have some discussion after each set, but we are running a little late, so I just want to give you a warning on that, although I think we're just about on time. So. I'm going to begin by presenting Anne Irwin's paper again. She can't be here today. Anne, as I said before, has been doing extensive fieldwork now since about 1995 with the Canadian infantry. And if I'm not mistaken, she's followed a platoon from the time that they actually joined the military all the way through several months of deployment in Kandahar. And the story that I'm going to be reading to you today is a story about some time that she spent in Kandahar in 2006. And the title of this paper is Military Ethnography and Embedded Journalism, Parallels, Intersections, and Disjuncture. And I'll try and keep this to 20 minutes, but I know Robert will happily cut me off. The morning of the 5th of July, before leaving Spin Boldock for Kandahar Air Force Base, the platoon warrant officer took me aside and told me I would not be going with the platoon. who said the official reason given by the company commander was that there was not enough room for me, since they had received a replacement soldier for someone who had been wounded, but they were also concerned about risk and liability. I was not clear, nor was he, whether the company commander was referring to the possibility that my presence during the operation would represent a liability in the sense of adding risk for the soldiers, or whether he was concerned about the military's liability for my safety. He told me I would stay in Spinboldak with 7th Platoon, which was staying behind to secure the forward operating base. Later in the evening, however, he came and told me that if I still wanted to go on the operation, I'd be permitted, but I'd have to travel with one of the company headquarters vehicles, which would be employed in a support role rather than engaged in any fighting. I agreed to the conditions of this participation and traveled back to Kandahar Air Force Base in the captain's vehicle. The 5th of July was spent loading ammunition and other supplies and going over plans. A number of the soldiers confided to me they were so frightened of going back to Panjawi that they were unable to eat, and several of them told me they had been vomiting with anxiety. A few soldiers gave me messages to pass on to their wives or parents in the event of their deaths. A sergeant confided in me about a prophetic dream of his own death in combat that he had had since childhood. He was convinced that his death would occur in Panjawi in the turret of an LAV, which is a military vehicle. A soldier asked me to ensure that if he were killed during the upcoming operation, that the affairs officers, would not use his official combat photo in the death notice, but one of the photos I had taken of him smiling with his platoon. Although I knew I would have limited, if any, influence, I told him I would do my best to see that his wishes were met. This vignette from the field illustrates some of the main differences between the projects of embedded journalism and military ethnography. Embedded journalists are there to report on events as they occur, and any understanding of social relations within the military unit is incidental to their primary goal. At best, understanding how social relations work in the unit adds context to their reporting of events. At the very least, understanding the society in which they are embedded makes it easier for them to get their job done. If they understand social relations and social norms, they can better manage their relations with soldiers and add nuance to their reporting. In contrast, understanding the social dynamics and relationships of the unit was the goal of my research. I had studied the same unit in the context of a peacetime army training for war, and now wanted to examine how those dynamics and relationships had changed in the context of combat. My desire to immerse myself as fully as possible in the life of the unit was predicated on a need to observe as much as possible to a full range of activities in which the group was engaged. The journalist that was with me, Christy Blatchford, who's apparently a very well-known Canadian journalist, was also embedded with the same unit, but her goal, she told me, was to be closer to the action, to be available to report on events as they unfolded. As pointed out by Peterson, the goal of ethnography is to capture the richness and the complexity of everyday life. News writers, in contrast, according to Bell, are engaged in a process of systematic and progressive simplification. The ethnographic endeavor is also explicitly situated in a particular theoretical tradition and seeks to contribute in some way to theoretical issues of interest to anthropologists. In my case, I was interested in how soldiers constitute their identities as soldiers through their everyday practices and negotiations with the military institution of which they are a part. With this goal in mind, I was interested in the everyday and the mundane, whereas Christy was after the story, as is evident in the account below. On the 9th of July, 2006, Charlie Company, consisting mostly of 8th Platoon with a few attachments, was involved in a two-day-long pitched battle in the Panjawi district of Kandahar province, Afghanistan, during which Corporal Tony Baneka was killed. During the battle itself, I was waiting anxiously with what members of the military call the echelon, those company members who provide immediate first-line support to the fighting troops. I was listening for casualty reports and trying to recognize the voices, even though they were distorted by the radio and by their panting brought on by the extreme heat. Someone who did not identify himself broadcast, "Boneka's down," a clear breach of radio protocol. Casualties are not supposed to be identified by name, and every transmission should be preceded by the call sign of the transmitter. Eventually, an armored ambulance pulled into the Leaguer and stopped about 50 meters away from our vehicle. When the ramp was lowered, one of the medics pulled a folding metal chair out and set it up in the shade of some fig trees bordering on a wheat field. A woman whom I recognized as Chrissy Blatchford came out and climbed out and sat on the chair. She appeared not to be wounded, but was in shock. Shortly afterwards, the medics helped 3 members of 8th Platoon dismount from the ambulance. They were all suffering from what the military calls heat wounds, and one of them turned out to be a broken leg sustained when throwing a hand grenade. The three of them sat on the shady bank, two of them with IVs inserted to replenish their lost bodily fluids. Two of these soldiers were men whom I knew very well, having spent much of the previous month with them in their vehicle. So I ran over to them to see how they were. One of the soldiers, John, who had been Tony Boneca's best friend, looked at me and said, "I hope he's satisfied now." I took the he to be referring to the unit's commanding officer, about whom all the soldiers had been complaining for weeks. They felt he'd been taking unnecessary risks with their lives in order to further his own career. I wanted to comfort him, but I didn't know what to say or how to say it, so I sat in uncomfortable silence with him. Finally, the other soldier, Frank, started to talk. With a tear trickling down his cheek, he told me how they had been unable to kill the man on the roof, that he seemed to be a trained soldier and had taken up a perfect firing position. He said, "We just couldn't kill him." Then he began to feel dizzy and nauseated, and the medic deemed that he needed oxygen, so we helped him back into the ambulance where the medic placed a mask over his face. Frank asked me to take a picture of him in the back of the ambulance for his wife, who was compiling a photo album of the tour. After about an hour, the ambulance crew announced they would be taking the three casualties back to Kandahar Air Force Base for medical treatment and asked Christy if she wanted to accompany them. She replied, "Yes, I've got my story. I'm ready to write and file it." The ambulance, along with an escort vehicle for protection, left with its load of soldiers and Christy. She told me later that as soon as she arrived back at Kandahar Air Force Base, she had written and filed her story, which appeared the next morning in a Canadian newspaper. The day of Tony's death is one of the 15 days that she covers in her book of the same title, which was published a year later in 2007. Now, it's weeks before members of 8 Platoon and I had a break in the forward operating base with internet access, and we had an opportunity to read Christy's account of Tony's death and the battle. The members of his platoon were dismayed by the graphic tone of the story, which recounted his blood dripping on the path over which he had walked. They were concerned his parents would have needlessly suffered reading the details of how he had died. This event, and Christie's and my reactions to it, exemplify some of the differences between military ethnography and embedded journalism. In the remainder of this essay, I want to explore how the differences in orientation to time and place, as well as the differences in how the two disciplines, and as well as differences in the two different disciplines, produce different authoritative accounts. As Ulf Hannerts points out, both journalists and anthropologists deal with the other and must establish their accounts as authoritative. In the case of embedded journalists and ethnographers of the military, the others we are representing are soldiers, and we both use our sustained presence with them as a means to establishing our authority to speak and write knowledgeably about them. However, the similarity is a superficial one. For the embedded journalist, for Christy, her presence is key to getting the story, because for the journalist, as Bell argues, the story is everything. What constitutes a story is limited, but the journalistic authority to tell the story comes from proximity in space and time. Proximity in space confers the authority to tell the story, whereas proximity in time confers the authority to tell a news story. For the journalist, then, who is competing with other journalists for the scoop, time is of the essence, and the story must be told in a timely fashion. The anthropologist must also establish her authority. It also comes from proximity, but what is of concern is not necessarily the events that constitute the story, but the reactions of persons to events. And authority comes from the length of the stay and from having come home again, from the reflection that is possible and the analysis that is enabled by distance from the field. Had there been no event to record on the 9th of July, my research would not have been impoverished. I would have had as much material to analyze, and the data would have shed just as much light on military-social relationships, identity formation, and norms, had there been no firefight and no death of a comrade. If the unit had spent the day sitting in a leaguer waiting for something to happen, the journalist might have considered it a waste of her time and would have wished herself elsewhere. The anthropologist would have worked with what was available and considered the day a rich source of data. This is not to suggest that some journalists are not interested in the quotidian and the mundane. There is indeed a genre of journalism which seeks to represent the lived experience of certain persons, and this genre does begin to approach ethnography in several ways. However, the writing of this genre of journalism is an accountable matter and must be somehow explained, excused, and formulated as something that is of interest beyond the better and normal reporting of events. The style of journalism can be framed as human interest or background journalism, but it does not fit easily in the dominant mode of journalistic discourse. Ethics. Both military anthropologists and journalists must consider the ethical dimensions of their work, but again, there are significant differences in their approaches to ethical concerns. After our return to Canada, I interviewed Christy Blatchford and asked her if she'd ever had any ethical concerns about her work, prefacing my question by the comment that I had struggled daily with ethical issues in my encounters with the platoon. Her response was that she had never had a single ethical problem, although other journalists had questioned her ethical stance. It became clear very quickly that we had differing assumptions about what constituted ethical work for our professions. In the ensuing discussion, Christy made it clear that for her and other journalists, the paramount ethical principle was not to be biased, but to report the facts of the story as accurately as possible. She had assumed that I was referring to the accusations that some have made about embedded journalists having been co-opted by the military establishment. Co-opted by the military establishment, and that their objectivity is therefore compromised. This is the argument raised by the posters. There was a form that she speaks about early in the chapter. The ethical dilemmas that troubled me, in contrast, were not about objectivity, but about whether my presence as a researcher was in any way adding to the risk to the soldiers who were sharing their lives with me. There are a number of occasions where the possibility that having to protect me would add significant hardship, and I worried about this. Another ethical concern I had was a result of the media presence in Afghanistan. I had promised to strive for anonymity for my informants, but since many of them had been identified by rank and name in news stories, and these were news stories about Anne being an anthropologist deployed with the military, it was much more difficult than it would have been otherwise to achieve an adequate level of protection of their privacy. Protection of privacy is certainly not one of the primary ethical principles of journalists, but it is for me. While it is true that some journalists have gone to great lengths, even to the extent of being incarcerated, to protect the identity of their anonymous informants, an authoritative journalistic account must, for the most part, include reference to individuals and their stories. For the anthropologist, the personal identity of participants in the research is less important than the patterns of observed behavior, and there is a long tradition of disguising and otherwise hiding individual identities. In conclusion, the conflation of my research with embedded journalism, which is something that has happened frequently, and it's happened on the internet, and you can actually look up some of the critique that Anne's gotten for this, is a conflation that is harder to dismiss, and indeed I've struggled with it since my return from Afghanistan. During the period of research, I came to an understanding of what distinguishes my work from that of the journalists around me who are embedded with the same people that I was studying, and who had been embedded with similar units before, during, and after my research. On the surface, embedded journalism in the military and the ethnography of deployed soldiers have many similarities. The immersion in what is popularly seen as a closed society, the necessity to establish the authority of one's accounts, the ethical dimensions of one's work. Yet because they have dramatically different goals in the production of their work and different orientations to time and space, perhaps the similarities on deeper inspection are superficial only, and the difference is more stark. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Eyal Ben-Ari. I'm from a place in Israel that my American students call Hebrew U. I've been doing research on various aspects of the military for 21 years, and it began my research basically based on my experience as an officer in an infantry unit in Israel. Like many Israeli men of my age, I served my 3 years as a conscript, was in the regulars for 1 year, and then I served as a reservist for 22 years, basically in the infantry. I've done either alone or with colleagues and students a variety of projects. The latest project that I'm involved in is related to the effect of the international humanitarian law on the actual operational level of the Israeli military. I presented my preliminary findings at a conference about 3 weeks ago to the Israeli military, and you'll be glad to know that two generals stopped talking to me after that presentation. What can one do? Oh, this is research enabled by the military itself. What I want to talk about today is peripherally related to my own research. I can talk about my research later during question time or during the reception, but more about this whole workshop. When I received and was very honored to get an invitation to participate in the SAR seminar, I went over the contents of the invitation a number of times, and I said to myself, this is very American. Why? Because I found over the years that very often Americans tend to use the word methodology or ethics when they mean politics. And I've had a number of experiences. I'll just mention two. The first, I gave a talk at Yale in 2002 on the experience of Israeli snipers who have killed Palestinians during the Second Palestinian Intifada. And one of the audience asked me during the Q&A time about the ethics of my fieldwork. And I thought he meant questions like the anonymity of the interviewees and so on. What he basically wanted to know was my political stance vis-a-vis the Palestinians. Am I left wing? Am I right wing? Where do I stand on the political map? Another example, I went to the talk, a very good talk that John Hunter gave on Los Alamos on Monday evening, and Jean Simonelli introduced the whole talk in a very nice way. But she said that Los Alamos raises a whole range of ethical and logistical problems. And as an Israeli, what was missing for me was the question of politics, state secrecy, state power, state violence, and so on. Now, when I say politics, an explicit focus on politics involves a whole range of issues. David Price, I think, may talk about it today, but he's written about this in the past. Certainly, the way, for example, in which our knowledge may be used by state actors or representatives, our positioning in the field, the internal politics of anthropology, the different political camps, which Marietta Baba talked about today during the panel, and, of course, what I'd like to develop, the idea of the moral worthiness of our collective action. The problem for me, I think, and I'm going to be purposely provocative, not just because I'm an Israeli, okay? The problem for me is that anthropology over the years has had a disciplinary, I would say, bias in terms of a commitment to the subordinate groups, to the subalterns, to the oppressed. And rightly so. This is not a critique. When I, who have studied the military, come and try to link into anthropological debates, especially in America, there is a problem because the people that I study in regard to Israel are the professional perpetrators of state violence, soldiers. This raises a question of what allegiance do I owe them? What kind of positioning do I have as an individual, as a citizen, vis-a-vis these professional soldiers? Today, what I'd like to do is three things which emanate from my position as a somewhat peripheral observer of American anthropologists. I say that this not to celebrate my peripherality, which is another mark of American anthropology. Okay, everybody celebrates their periphery. Forget the cynicism. I have to behave myself this evening. I want to do three things in the time allotted me, and I'm well aware of that. Situate the current controversy over the relations between anthropologists and the military as a peculiarly American rendering of global academic processes that mark anthropology. To contend that while heavily colored by American biases, this debate nevertheless carries implications for scholars around the world, such as myself. And three, to maintain, and this may be my most controversial point, is that we have a political and moral duty to continue studying the military, including, this is my emphasis, studies enabled by the military. This does not mean that there are problems with this enablement, but this is, I think, central to what we do. The current controversy, if I read it correctly, going through blogs, newspapers, and so on, is marked by a very adversarial, I would say, kind of relationship within American anthropologists in and around this issue, if I may. And, of course, this is related to a whole range of issues, to the, I would say, the intense wariness, often justified, of anthropologists of the military and of the state, related to anthropology's identification with the underdog, with liberal values. This is a very American term, which is strange to people coming from the outside. But basically, I would say left-wing, to translate it into my kind of language, commitment. The continued debate about anthropology's colonial past, not only the United States, the Netherlands, Japan, Germany, Austria, you find this around the world. And, of course, the legacy of American imperialism, whether it be in Latin America or Southeast Asia, and currently, and I'm saying this as an arguable point, in Iraq and Afghanistan. But I think that the severity of the tone, the emotional chargedness, I'm not a native speaker of English, so I invent these English words every once in a while. The emotional charge is related, and I would at least throw out the idea, to the moral and Puritan origins of American culture. That is, in a way, by saying I'm ethical, one says something about oneself as a moral worthy individual. And in that way, sometimes there is a use of ethics in a strategic sense of saying something about ourselves. And of course, the way current American politics is still marked by a heavy emphasis on partisanship. I understand that President Obama is trying to get across some of these issues, but certainly it's part of, I would say, the historical context of continued of America today. One point about Israeli anthropology is that in Israel, anthropologists have hardly been used in order to know the Arab other. In Israel, this has been the monopoly of what, roughly translated, and today, after Said, it sounds terrible, Orientalists, in Hebrew, Mizrachanim, basically historians and, to an extent, political scientists who carry a monopoly over knowing the other. And they're allied with military people, intelligence services, and so on. Anthropologists have been at the periphery of this knowledge of the other. Anthropologists have basically dealt with, in terms of nation building, the absorption of immigrants. They've come under intense criticism for this. And to my knowledge, over the last 50 years, there have been only two Israeli anthropologists who have participated with the security establishment in research on Arabs. And one of them has become, Emmanuel Marx, has become an advocate for the Bedouins who live in the southern desert of Israel. But having said that, I'm not off the proverbial political or moral hook. This is where I want to take the discussion back to American anthropology, if I may. In a wide-ranging article that appeared in the Annual Review of Anthropology, I think last year, Hugh Gusterson, in an article called Anthropology and the Military, which really got me mad because it's actually only on the United States, Gusterson invokes a dichotomy between the good and the bad anthropologists. The virtuous scholars are those that are focused, and I quote, on the deformative features of American militarism. And the virtuous ones include Karen Nordstrom, Catherine Lutz, and of course himself. The anthropologists who are to be condemned are those that are, and again I quote, contracted to, enabled by, or in a broad sense, allied with the military. Notice he homogenizes a whole range of kinds of links into one category. In this group, Gustafson includes such anthropologists as John Hawkins, Anna Simons, and the anthropologists appearing in the edited volume by Freze and Harrell. I hope I'm pronouncing the name correctly. It seems that anthropologists who work as subcontractors for the military are not the only ones that are to be condemned. Anybody enabled by the military is to be condemned. So, I find this really interesting that this division into the world, and I'm talking as an external observer of you today, okay? As an external observer, this dichotomy of good and bad, virtuous and condemned, in an inverse form, replicates the dichotomy of George W. Bush, of dividing the world into... I've done work on Japan, so we have to watch it. Numazaki-san. Dividing the world into the good and the bad, the axis of evil. I can go into this. I will not go into this. Within this dichotomy, anthropologists such as myself are basically polluted. We are polluted in the symbolic, in the deep symbolic sense that Mary Douglas talks about, by our very association with the military. We're contaminated symbolically. And the only way to... the only solution is the way you solve any kind of cultural anomaly. You purify the people. To use Gustafson's metaphor, from deformed, we have to become reformed anthropologists. Very interesting in the panel this morning that a number of anthropologists talked about, applied anthropologists as working in the swamp, as being dirty, not clean, like the pure anthropologists who are in academia. If I may, for the next one. But the situation is actually more complex than this, because I started to ask myself, how is all of this related to the power relations within American academic anthropology? And again, I may be wrong. Take this as an hypothesis. The anthropologists enabled by the military have considerable power since they're allied with state agents, right? Laura works with Sandia, and she has the U.S. government behind her. Many such scholars seek the recognition of the state, not Laura, and wish to influence policy and implementation, I think, authentically. But within the discipline, these anthropologists are often in a position of weakness. What I'm about to say is not a normative, but a descriptive argument. Applied anthropologists tend to be at a lower, if you like, at a lower scale in terms of the internal hierarchy within American anthropology. So what you have with the network of concerned anthropologists, implying that other anthropologists are unconcerned, is the pure theorists, the people committed to the real, the authentic, the non-polluted anthropologists, critiquing the applied anthropologists who are enabled by the military. This has led me to something which I found through my experience, and that is our very structural dependency forces people such as myself to adopt... 5 minutes? 5 minutes. Right. To adopt the way we present our findings to an American theoretical audience. I've encountered time and time again, whenever I talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, a sort of what I call a compulsory indignation or obligatory ire. I have to say I'm against the occupation. I have to say where I stand politically or nobody will listen to what I'm saying. That is, I have to signal my political allegiance before what I takes what I say is taken seriously by many, not all, by many American anthropologists, to a lesser extent in Europe. But I find this, leading to a deeper problem, and that is that whenever I present, or over the years when I've written for anthropological journals here in America, and I've had a number of articles, two articles published in American Ethnologist, which was very good for my career in Israel, I could not phrase, or if I were to, I initially tried phrasing my analysis in terms of a focus on the military, one on Japan, Japanese contemporary Japanese military, and the other on the militaries of the industrial democracies. If I would, when I tried to phrase it in terms of a focus on the military, the articles were not accepted. When I phrased it in terms of violence, that is, what is accepted among American, the core American contemporary anthropologists as worthy of study, the articles were accepted. Please let me be clear, I'm not complaining. Okay? I've received very good comments, and it really improved the articles themselves. But what I want to get across is that these structural dependencies of applied anthropologists on pure anthropologists, of people such as myself from the semi-periphery of Israel on the American Academic Center, these things imply certain modes of the production of knowledge about the military and so on. My last point, you see, I've been socialized in Japan, okay, so to be on time. It's not my military background. Last point I would like to make is that I think we have an imperative to study the military, even work that is enabled by the military, funded by the military. Too often, I read work on violence by American anthropologists that focus only on the victims. Nancy Shepherd Hughes has turned this into an art. Okay? A literature of anguish. Now, this is an important emphasis. But if one wants to take violence seriously, as Brian Ferguson has done and others, one has to focus both on the perpetrators and the victims. The problem is that anthropologists have ceded the study of the military to other disciplines, sociology, political science, international relations, psychology, and so on. If we want to understand violence, we have to address the perpetrators themselves. And in this sense, the military. The military is the organization which is charged with the legitimate, if contested, use of organized violence. If we do not study it, we've lost our cause of studying violence. In this sense, my work, which has been enabled by the military, but focuses, for example, on snipers or on the effects of international humanitarian law and human rights law, would not be possible without working with the military. In the past, the military has censored one of the chapters in a forthcoming book. It may censor things in the future. There is a trade-off, but engagement always contains elements of trade-off, negotiation, and compromise. I, for one, am willing to pay the price, or certain prices, but to gain access that otherwise I would not gain if I did not work through the military, that is, through the institutions themselves. Thank you very much. Okay.
All right, y'all, I apologize for not having introduced you, but I'm going to make it up, pay it forward by introducing Danny Hoffman.
That's going to be very tough to follow. Actually, I don't have any PowerPoint slides, so I wonder, would somebody be willing to flip the lights on? Great. Part of the reason for that you'll hear in just a second, but first of all, let me just say thank you to you all for coming, and to Laura and the others for inviting me to be here. As Laura said in the beginning, I'm a latecomer to this. It's better. There we go. I'm a latecomer to this group, and it's really an honor for me to be invited to participate. And so I'm very grateful to everybody that's kind of made some room for me here. I'm going to start off then, after the thank yous, with the apologies and the caveats. I have kind of a double whammy here. This is new material for me, and I have new babies at home. So I have not slept in weeks, and therefore I'm going to read this paper. So I apologize for that. I'll try to make it entertaining, look up as much as I can, but I'm going to go ahead and read these the remarks. The title of the paper is The Subcontractor, Counterinsurgency, Militias, and the New Common Ground in Social and Military Science. Now, I'd like to begin with an event that received very little attention in the U.S. media. On October 1, 2008, the United States military's Africa Command, or AFRICOM, became fully operational. For the first time, AFRICOM makes sub-Saharan Africa the exclusive focus of an entire apparatus of U.S. military services. But of the six regions that make up military's unified command structure, AFRICOM is unique. It hosts relatively few U.S. troops, and its focus is civilian-military partnerships. Half of AFRICOM staff is civilian, not military. Its mission is a complex mix of training support, disaster, and humanitarian relief efforts, development assistance, and economic projects. Now, I begin this talk with the largely unnoticed inauguration of AFRICOM because it illustrates an important absence in the discussions about the relationship between social science and the global security sector today. For the past few years, that conversation has been dominated by military programs like the human terrain system and by concerns over mercenary anthropology in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. As important as those debates are, and I'm not trying to minimize them, they overshadow more ambiguous contexts in which social scientists encounter the security sector. I argue in this paper that changes in the United States military philosophy and structure represented by AFRICOM make it more likely that in the future, scholarly and military research will overlap at a level I refer to here as that of the subcontractor. Now, what I mean by this is that field researchers are most likely to find themselves in circumstances in which the labor of war and the knowledge production about war have been outsourced. Counterinsurgency operations are increasingly central to the U.S. military mission worldwide, a development with profound ramifications for local communities and for community-based social sciences. And I apologize after the first paper. This is very much an American military-centric paper, but hopefully it has wider implications. Counterinsurgency strategy increasingly seeks to mobilize local populations to provide for their own security or to assist regular troops in doing so. This greatly expands the number of social scientists, particularly anthropologists, whose work will overlap with U.S. and other security apparatuses and shifts the kinds of demands that will be placed on scholarly knowledge. Overtly, quote, helping the military win is the extreme case of social scientists' relationship to military science, but is one that doesn't necessarily address the practical, theoretical, and ethical challenges most ethnographers face when they come into contact with or are asked to serve as the subcontractors of war. Now, here I take the proliferation of militias in the recent conflict in West Africa's Mono River region as emblematic of the future overlap between social and military science. In Sierra Leone and Liberia, local community defense forces received considerable training, material, and logistic support from a range of international actors interested in the outcome of the war, but unwilling or unable to commit conventional state or multinational combat forces. This was an outsourced war. The result was the militarization of an entire region. In a profound reorganization of social, economic, and political landscapes, young men were made available for rapid assembly and deployment wherever and whenever necessary, fighting as part-time combatants against a highly decentralized, networked enemy. Now, this mode of outsourcing violence to local communities is increasingly important to how U.S. military thinkers approach global security. For social scientists, this means the figure of the embedded professional researcher grows obsolete, even as programs like the human terrain system are in their infancy. The future promises less demand for the kind of, quote, culture knowledge that an embedded researcher can provide, and fewer of the large deployments of combat troops that gave rise to the human terrain teams in Afghanistan and Iraq. AFRICOM's blurring of the lines between foreign aid and security, civilian and military agents, battlefields, and development projects suggest a completely different terrain of the future. On the one hand, this avoids some of the more pressing contemporary debates over the propriety of working for the military. On the other, it presents a different set of quandaries and possibilities for what it means to do politically committed and ethical fieldwork. Now, the large troop deployments that characterize the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are not the future of American war. Instead, the mission is increasingly to deploy indirectly, working with and through more knowledgeable and better positioned surrogate forces, and doing so in a way that complicates the war-peace divide. U.S. Army Colonel Gregory Wilson, in a 2006 article on counterinsurgency in Military Review, argued that in a successful counterinsurgency operation, small units of American special forces should work in peacetime and, in his term, invisibly, through local forces. Quote, therefore, the U.S. war on terrorism strategy should emphasize working directly through, by, and with indigenous forces and building their capacity to conduct effective operations against common enemies, end quote. The trend, in other words, is toward finding local partners and outsourcing the labor of war. And the point I wish to emphasize here is that the local partners in question might be, but are not necessarily, the official militaries of recognized states. Wilson repeatedly speaks of alliances with indigenous or surrogate forces rather than with national militaries. The abstract language of partnerships, surrogates, and indigeneity appears throughout both official military publications and the language of security sector strategists and observers. This is not terribly surprising, given the U.S. government views that the security services of a number of so-called rogue nations and failed states are complicit in the operations of non-state networks like al-Qaeda. The upshot is that a great deal of the investment of U.S. military resources is currently dedicated to the cultivation of local forces, with no a priori assumption that the army of the state is the force most suitable for that aid. Now, what this amounts to in cases where the official state army is not the most reliable or desirable partner for the U.S. military is the militarization of other socio-political formations, or the creation of new militarized sodalities. The concern of many, quote, culturalists within the U.S. military is increasingly to identify indigenous modes of mobilization and to put them to work in the interest of security. The awakening movement in Iraq is the most high-profile recent example. In his summary of the lessons learned from the U.S. military's engagement with Iraq's social structures, Lieutenant Colonel Michael Eisenstadt writes that if Iraq is ever stabilized, it will be in large measure due to the, quote, leveraging of Iraq's tribes and tribal networks, end quote, in mobilizations such as the Anbar Awakening. I turn now, however, to another example of such community mobilizations, an unlikely one to be sure, but nevertheless a case study capable of shedding light on the mechanisms by which social networks become militarized and the consequences for scholars and strategists when they do. Now, the war in Sierra Leone, which is where I did the fieldwork and the case study that I'm working with here, the war in Sierra Leone officially began on the 27th of March, 1991, with a small invasion force crossing the eastern border with Liberia. For a war in a small country seemingly so peripheral to world politics and the global economy, the conflict in Sierra Leone involved an incredible array of international actors and networks. This included dissident political networks that stretched across the region, networks of arms and drugs that were truly global in scope, and even a connection to the diamond trade through the diamond trade to al-Qaeda and militant forms of Islam. Now, the Mono River War, and that term Mono River War implies both the fighting in Sierra Leone and Liberia, was also unique for the major role played by an African armed intervention force, with the United Nations, the U.S., and European countries unwilling to deploy their own forces as peacekeepers or peace enforcers until very late in the conflict. Nigeria spearheaded the first regional intervention after the Cold War, to which the United Nations agreed to be a secondary supporting partner. Now, it's the domestic partners that these international forces found on the ground that are the most significant for my purposes here. The Commajors were a decentralized group of grassroots civil defense units that appeared in the early 1990s in southeastern Sierra Leone. As the war progressed and it became clear that the state army was unable and in many cases unwilling to protect rural communities from violent attacks, the Commajors were the key figures around which young men mobilized to defend rural communities. Conducting patrols, ambushes, and intelligence gathering operations, the Commajors rapidly expanded their numbers across the southeast, waging a low-intensity conflict against both the rebels and often against the untrustworthy Republic of Sierra Leone armed forces. The Commodore's security presence was crucial to the conduct of trade, farming, water collection, the everyday modalities of village life in West Africa. Now, when a new democratically elected government was overthrown in 1997 by the state army, the Commodores became an even more important factor in the war. As the primary domestic resistance to the military junta, their numbers rapidly expanded. Commodores around the country coordinated their activities and received material from the Nigerian forces. These forces were in turn supported and advised by U.S. security contractors like Pacific Architects and Engineers and the military affairs officers at U.S. and European embassies in the region. When the junta was overthrown a year later, the Comajores were the government's only functioning security apparatus, despite their irregular status. Now, the Comajores were officially disbanded at the end of the war in 2002, and up to this point, you could sort of say that this was a fairly successful movement. My concern is what happened in the immediate aftermath of the end of the war. A poorly designed and executed disarmament program left thousands of former fighters displaced and without work. Large numbers of demobilized fighters moved across the border with Liberia to work as mercenaries on that front, or labored in the violent and unregulated diamond mines of the East. In the former case, these mobile warriors were armed through U.S. military assistance supplied to the Guinean government and then forwarded to the rebels. Ex-combatants deployed from rural communities to the cities during the war were simply abandoned there. These young men lacked the capital, both financial and social, to return to their villages. They currently live a precarious existence in the country's urban centers, available for recruitment by a diverse array of political and economic actors interested in utilizing their violence. This highly mobile population of militarized and marginalized young men poses the greatest threat to regional stability in a highly volatile region. Now, though it seems far removed from the center of the post-9/11 geopolitical world, Sierra Leone's history is a laboratory of the future. The Comajores are exactly the kind of indigenous force envisioned as partners in the current strategic thinking of U.S. military planners and commentators. They were without question the faction most loyal to the democratically elected and U.S.-friendly government after 1996, certainly much more so than the state army, which was notoriously corrupt and widely known to be colluding with the rebels. As key social actors in the local cultural landscape, they had the respect and support of local communities. They were a logical choice around which to base a counterinsurgency strategy, well-positioned to act on the kind of, quote, ethnographic intelligence seen as key to the new way of war. Perhaps even more important, the Comajore militia was structured along the lines that network theorists of war envision as most effective for counterinsurgency operations. The militia combined its ethnographic intelligence with a decentralized organization that allowed it to mobilize quickly wherever necessary. They were a truly grassroots organization, materializing as needed throughout the country in response to specific threats. Local units could act independently, move quickly, and adjust themselves to rapidly changing circumstances and new threats. What the Comajores amounted to was the militarization of everyday life and local communities such that they could be quickly mobilized and deployed as necessary in the interest of security. Initiatives like AFRICOM and other trends in the reorganization of global security are laying the groundwork for continued mobilizations of exactly this kind. AFRICOM is part of a generic discourse on African security that would like to see so-called African solutions to African problems. Regional peacekeeping and peace-enforcing operations are the model being pushed to deal with future conflict zones. Ad hoc coalitions of the willing, with minimal advising, financial and logistical support from the U.S., the UN, and contracted private security companies. If past experience is anything to judge by, these forces will not receive the levels of support necessary to operate effectively, even as demand on them grows. The upshot is that they will have to work with local surrogate forces like the Comajores. In fact, since it is in keeping with the U.S. military's culturalist turn to work with local surrogates, it is easy to imagine AFRICOM's trainers and security advisors encouraging its African partner forces to do just that. Jeremy Keenan, in his review of AFRICOM's operational status, writes that, quote, the indications are that AFRICOM's mission will be outsourced to contractors, notably private military companies. No doubt he is correct, but it is the subcontractors of war, like the Comajores, who will likely do most of the fighting. Now, where does this leave anthropologists? As U.S. and other security forces expand their sphere of operations, as the groundwork is laid for peacetime collection of ethnographic intelligence, and as indigenous mechanisms of mobilization become of greater interest to security services, many more anthropologists will find themselves working in areas of concern to military science or overlapping with actual areas of operation. If the future terrain of war is the mobilization of social networks and the militarization of everyday life, then the separate domains of military and social science begin to converge. This overlap potentially brings a much greater range of anthropologists into dialogue with the military than simply those who choose to work for it. The question is how. Now, in the chapter version of this talk, I argue that this opens a number of possible points of engagement that called for anthropologists to bear witness without necessarily being strictly oppositional to the U.S. security apparatus. We can occupy the space increasingly left vacant by investigative journalism, a critical but nuanced relationship that calls for collaboration and critique. I also make a case for anthropologists' involvement in designing disarmament campaigns, which have been notoriously ineffective in Africa as they have been elsewhere, largely because they take no account of the social forces that lead young men to participate in militias in the first place. But what I want to conclude with here is the suggestion that it is actually in the realm of theory that anthropologists have the most to contribute in the to the understandings of security, and that we can do so in ways both more important and less ethically fraught than the notion of the embedded anthropologist. What we learn from the Sierra Leone example and countless others more familiar to social scientists than to most other witnesses is that these militant mobilizations of existing social networks are not easily demobilized. More often, they become critical and often dangerous players in the mode of popular politics that governs the world today. Providing payment and logistical support to marginal young men to act as security guards or militia fighters is an act of employment, not only deployment, that cannot simply be revoked in a state with little economic opportunity for youth. All of this was true of the Commodores of Sierra Leone, and has been and will continue to be elsewhere. Now, as military interest in open-source ethnographic knowledge continues to grow, it will be less and less relevant whether the anthropologists who understand these on-the-ground realities choose to speak their truths directly to military or intelligence personnel. The more important point will be that anthropologists not be restricted in their ability to conduct research in conflict zones and that their knowledge be put into circulation. No doubt there will be opportunities for those who would choose to conduct classified research under security service auspices, but that model of knowledge production will remain much less significant than the work of anthropologists as teachers and the anthropological material in academic journals and popular media that are now required reading for many military culturalists. This is not necessarily something that anthropologists should shy away from. The key intervention in the future is not a laundry list of cultural traits or ethnographic details envisioned by the HTS program. The real contribution is a theoretical one, an understanding of how violence works as a social force, the consequences of mobilization and militarization, and what it means to employ social formations for violent ends. Now here, ironically, we may yet see the revalorization of theory, or at least the end of the pointless applied versus theoretical divide. This has been one of the undercurrents of much of the debate over HTS and the relative positioning of social sciences scientists within the academy versus those working directly within military institutions. This creates an entertaining debate, but one that obscures a more important point. The vision of cultural knowledge or ethnographic intelligence as bits and pieces of useful data that underlies the HTS is not where military and social science really meet. The more productive and, much, to my mind, much less ethically fraught common ground is the realm of theory. This is the terrain we should investigate by exploring what happens when existent social networks become militarized subcontractors of war and what we, the subcontractors of knowledge production, can do about it. So I'll end there. Thank you very much. And I stayed awake through the whole thing, which was somewhat in question.
All right. As strange as this sounds, I'm actually on a double strike. And my first strike is I'm not using PowerPoint for 1 year. And my second strike is I'm not printing anymore. I'm trying to go paperless, which is why I'm reading off my laptop. I'm sure at some point in a few years going to find this all profoundly prescient. The title of my paper is Torture, Interrogation, and the Global War on Terrorism, The Importance of Politically Engaged Scholarship. The global war on terror is more than a ground war. Indeed, as the United States government attempts to trace the lines of terrorist organizations and the extremist movements, the global war on terror begins to take on the contours of a massive law enforcement operation, with multiple parallel investigations ongoing to discover and apprehend individuals involved in the generation, planning, and execution of terrorist events, both potential and realized. In this transnational, somewhat deterritorialized, but often deeply local space, which is part crime scene and part battlefield, it is no accident that the United States has apprehended and detained thousands of people in multiple geographical locations and conducted literally tens of thousands of interrogations. And by April 2006, at Guantanamo alone, there had been 25,000 interrogation events that had taken place over 4 years, and that's only Guantanamo. Now, since about 2006, as an anthropologist and as a citizen who's profoundly concerned about our democracy, I've become interested in, and I think my husband would probably say obsessed, with the evolution of United States counterterrorism practices and policies in the global war on terror. I've spent an inordinate amount of my free time, usually around 4 o'clock in the morning, downloading and reviewing primary sources related to the development and implementation of detention and interrogation strategies in the United States. And quite frankly, I've done so not because I am intrinsically interested in interrogation, although I am now, but largely out of frustration with the way that anthropology's popular discourse in this regard just didn't seem to be meeting the mark. In this talk, I'm going to review the origins of and critique that discourse and present an alternative set of frames for engaging with what I consider to be one of the sentinel issues for the evolution of civil liberties in the United States in the post-9/11 era, and that is the rising institution of counterterrorism interrogation and its coalescence into a formal set of practices, institutions, and legal standards for how we engage with terrorism suspects. So with that, let's go to the beginning. The Abu Ghraib scandal broke on April 28, 2004, when the CBS television news magazine 60 Minutes 2 ran a story that included photographs of naked, hooded detainees being humiliated by young military personnel from the Army's 320th Military Police Battalion. In 2004, 2 days after 60 Minutes 2 broke the story, journalist Seymour Hersh published a series of articles in The New Yorker in which he described the institutional conditions, policy processes, and decisions that had culminated in the events at Abu Ghraib. Now, for anthropologists, I think most of us in this room know where this is going, Hersh's account became very specifically disconcerting when The New Yorker published the third in his series, an article called The Gray Zone, in which Hersh implied a role for an ethnography, Raphael Patel's 1973 book, The Arab Mind, as a source of information and inspiration for policymakers formulating a secret coercive interrogation strategy, a torture strategy, that relied on sexual humiliation and blackmail of Arab detainees. Hersh quoted a single anonymous source in asserting a role for this book as the intellectual foundation for interrogation strategies based on force, sexual humiliation, and even blackmail via photograph. And I think at this point it's actually worth, if you haven't recently reread this article, and there's no reason you should have, quoting the passage that gets brought up again and again in anthropological discourse about this problem. Hersh writes, "The notions that Arabs are particularly vulnerable to sexual humiliation became a talking point among pro-war Washington conservatives in the months before the March 2003 invasion of Iraq. One book that was frequently cited was The Arab Mind, a study of Arab culture and psychology, first published in 1973 by Raphael Patai, a cultural anthropologist who taught at Columbia and Princeton and who died in 1996. The book includes a 25-page chapter on Arabs and sex, depicting sex as a taboo vested with shame and repression. The segregation of the sexes, the veiling of the women, and all the other minute rules that govern and restrict contact between men and women have the effect of making sex a prime mental preoccupation in the Arab world," Patai wrote. "Homosexual activity or any indication of such leanings is never given any publicity. They are private affairs and remain in private." The Patai book, an academic told Hersh, was the Bible of the neocons on Arab behavior. In their discussions, the academic said, two themes emerged. One, that Arabs only understand force, and two, that the biggest weakness of Arabs is shame and humiliation. Now, reading the above paragraphs, and actually in the seminar in the summer, we got into quite a discussion about this. The more you read them, the more you realize that Hersh's allegations about the Arab mind in Abu Ghraib comprise no more than a loose collection of associations. It's a lot of words without a whole lot of direct facts. However, the idea that Patai's book was used in torture became so thoroughly embedded in the public consciousness that even commentators on Amazon.com, this was just last year, were linking the book to court torture. And one guy wrote, "Wondering where the torture techniques at Abu Ghraib and Gitmo came from? This is the neocon Kama Sutra." In anthropology, people were similarly upset about the book. Nadia Abu al-Haj wrote, quote, that the character of torture was determined by a particular vision of Arab-Muslim culture. The source of that knowledge for those who prosecuted the war and for those who designed the system of torture was none other than the Orientalist scholar Raphael Patai. In 2006, Carolyn Fleur-Loban wrote that a May 2004 New Yorker article revealed that The Arab Mind, written by deceased anthropologist Raphael Patai, may have been used as a manual for intensive interrogation, which some argue is torture, at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. Now, the Sturm und Drang around The Arab Mind translated into political action on the part of the American Anthropological Association in 2006, with the passage of a resolution against the use of anthropological knowledge in torture. It derived from two concerns. First, the American Psychological Association's own dramatic debates about the very well-established role of mental health professionals in torture at Guantanamo and at Abu Ghraib and in other locations. And, not surprisingly, the Hirsch article. And in an article in Anthropology News that was written about the resolution, the Hirsch article was cited as a prime driver for this, and I'll read this. This is from Anthropology News, and it's about that resolution. Early evidence of using culture as a weapon came from the Abu Ghraib scandal revealed in 2004. That year, the journalist Seymour Hirsch reported in the New Yorker on the brutal practices of U.S. personnel at the Iraqi prison. Hirsch included a quote from an unnamed academic who noted that the anthropologist Raphael Patai's book, The Arab Mind, was the Bible of the neocons on Arab behavior. Hirsch implied that Patai's depiction of sex as a taboo vested with shame and repression provided U.S. interrogators with culturally specific material that could be used to recruit Iraqi informants, and with or without official approval, to develop torture policies and techniques tailor-made for Iraqi prisoners. It's true, this marks a new and dangerous phase in applied anthropology. In the immediate wake of the resolution, what my colleague Gregory Starrett, who is a Middle East scholar, described as a largely pointless game of chercher le livre, or go find the book, leaned briefly toward becoming a game of chercher l'anthropologue, go find the anthropologist, when Gerald Sider decried scum with PhDs who stand side by side with torturers. Now, what's interesting about all of this is that in the writings about the role of Patai's book in Abu Ghraib, there was no additional scholarship, or very little additional scholarship. Indeed, in reviewing the literature in anthropology and on the internet, and there's still about between 175 and 200,000 hits if you go to Google and you do a search on this stuff, the source that is consistently mentioned over and over again is Seymour Hirsch, and there are no additional sources that actually corroborate this that I've been able to find. Although that doesn't mean that people in the military are not reading Raphael Patai, they're reading all kinds of stuff about Arab culture, which actually I think says something very interesting about the reconfiguration of the national security state in the post-9/11 era, but I'll get to that. The problem with this is that since 2003, the Department of Defense has actually conducted 13 official investigations into the goings-on at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and in Afghanistan, producing several hundred thousand pages of documents, many of which are publicly available thanks to the American Civil Liberties Union, which maintains a website with access, and indeed it's keyword searchable. This is what I spend most of my mornings digging through. What this collection reveals and what the investigations revealed was that Patai's book did not play much of a role, if any of a role, in the formulation of torture strategies. The root of all evil in this case is something called SEER, or a program called Survival Evasion Resistance Escape, which is used, it's a special forces training program that's used to harden soldiers in case they get into the kind of situations, ironically, that people in Abu Ghraib were in, or in case they were going to be tortured during times of conflict. It's pretty clear now that SEER was essentially reverse engineered to create the Abu Ghraib torture techniques, and this is very well documented. And in fact, there are people who have actually been through SEER, a couple of whom I've talked to, that said that as soon as they saw what was going on at Abu Ghraib and learned about what was going on in Guantanamo, that was the first thing they thought of was SEER. So, at the suggestion of my friend Carolyn Fleur Loban, so I was doing all this research, and she and I were going back and forth about this in a different context, and she said to me, well, have you actually talked to Seymour Hirsch to figure out where he got this stuff? And this is where things get really interesting. So I actually wrote Seymour Hirsch a letter, and I didn't expect him to reply to me. And then I walked into my office in July of 2007, and my message light was blinking on my phone, and it was a voicemail from Seymour Hirsch. It was this very abrupt, Dr. McNamara, call me immediately, and he left me his home number, which I still have posted up on my board. And I called him, and after a few days of phone tag, I actually caught him at his desk, and I introduced myself, and he said, Dr. McNamara, I got your letter. I mean, he doesn't mess around with niceties. He's like a machine gun. Dr. McNamara, I got your letter. I want to make something clear. I don't think there is a connection between Patai's book and Abu Ghraib. He explained to me that he'd include the reference to Patai as a way of illustrating the kind of stereotyping that he saw about Arabs in the Bush administration. But he emphasized he'd never intended readers to impute a formal role for the Arab mind as a torture manual. Indeed, he seemed rather taken aback at the uproar that a few paragraphs in his magazine article had created. And he said to me, "Didn't people read the rest of the article? Is that all you anthropologists read? Was that one paragraph?" And I would explain to him that anthropologists had actually much broader concerns about disciplinary linkages to torture. For example, if people were actually out training interrogators. He said, "Look, I don't know if anybody's actually looked into whether or not there are any institutional linkages. Have you looked into it? Has anybody looked into it? And you should know that I wrote what I wrote, but I don't think there was anything formal about Pattaya and torture." I thought to myself later, I was talking to a friend of mine who's a journalist, and he said, "Well, did you get permission to quote her? You know, you should write about this. It's the closest I've ever seen him come to a redaction." And I said, or retraction, and I said, "No, I didn't." He said, "Well, you should call him back." And I thought, "Well, I don't really want to do that," because he was getting irritable towards the end of our conversation. So I went ahead and called him back, though. And I caught him in the morning, and he said, "What do you want to talk about? You want to talk more about this torture stuff?" And I, at this point, I was frantically taking notes, and I said, "Well, I'd like to be able to quote you." And he said to me somewhat testily, "This is making a mountain out of a molehill. This is ridiculous. It's one paragraph. Look what I wrote. Did I write that? Did I actually write anthropologists were torturing people? Read what I wrote, and that's all you need. It's not my fault if people misquote me." And then he said, "But with all due respect, Ms. McNamara, why do you need me to make that argument? If you're doing research, you should know what's going on. What I know is right there. And the guy who told me this, he was a chicken shit anyway. He actually was an academic. He was a military officer, and all he wanted to do was crawl up the chain of command. That's all he cared about. He didn't even want me to quote him on this, and I didn't think it was such a big deal. Anyway, I can't control how people interpret or use what I write, and I don't have any more information than what I wrote." And then he was moving on to a big series on Iran, and he said, "I don't want to talk about this anymore." And then I said to him, "Can I quote you?" And he said, "Quote me? Quote me on what? That I didn't write what I didn't write? Listen, I've had the Bush administration say that I threw a bunch of mud on the wall about Abu Ghraib just to see what would stick. They think I'm full of shit. Now, why should I care about what a bunch of anthropologists think about what I wrote or how they're interpreting it?" I think there's a tremendous irony here. And that irony is the way that anthropology, anthropologists worrying so deeply about the implications of our knowledge in the hands of people in power and how it will be used. We have this profound obsession with this, I think, and rightly so, are leveraging the work of a journalist citing a single anonymous source who was hiding his identity. And Hirsch had no, as Anne Irwin talks about, temporal or physical proximity to these conversations as they were taking place. We're actually seen as, I think, an exclamation point to a larger issue of what y'all, I think, would probably call a very political issue about the relationship between anthropology and the government. As anthropology worries about how its knowledge will endure and the implications of that enduring knowledge for the people that we study and work with, Hirsch's claims were seen by many anthropologists as a final cautionary tale about the dangers of blindly handing over ethnographic products to the military state. The meaning of this tale was self-evident. Given the opportunity, people in the military are going to put anthropological scholarship to unethical and inhumane ends. And our job is to speak out loudly and clearly against such abuses. Point taken, case demonstrated. Except that I think we actually failed to open the case. Are you telling me that I have how much? 5 minutes, thank you. Except that I think we actually failed to open the case in the first place. And that in essentially ending the discussions around the use of a book at Abu Ghraib, instead of using it as a chance to ask more questions about what happened, we are not creating enduring critique. Anthropologists, after all, have a great deal to say about torture, war, conflict, and imprisonment and violence. But as a sociocultural site in which the state directly engages the individual in a place of extreme power dynamics, interrogation is a largely unmarked category in our discourse, with, of course, the exception of Marcel Salins and the destruction of conscience in Vietnam and some of Leslie Gill's work on School of the Americas. At the same time, interrogation is often conceptually linked with torture. It is the discursive score that accompanies acts of torture or is critically juxtaposed against torture as a more humane and legal process for eliciting information from individuals. This is far too simple a framing for anthropology, or it should be. Indeed, legal scholar Richard Leo warns us that interrogation is a complex site in which play out fundamental and perhaps irreconcilable paradoxes about the relationship between the citizen and the state in consensual democracy. I think there are three ways in which anthropologists can engage counterterrorism interrogation in which we should. The first is to think of interrogation as culture, as a form of practice inside an institutional culture. We can examine the profession as an epistemic culture, a mutually constitutive collection of experts, techniques, technologies, symbols, and strategies that is emerging and evolving as people are pursuing a collectively defined and valued knowledge goal, and that is the formation of interrogation strategies that will break terrorists. In the context of the global war on terror, a new subdiscipline interrogation is indeed emerging, and it is an amalgamation of three areas of traditional interrogation that have been kept separate functionally in the United States government: military interrogation for order of battle issues, intelligence interrogation for more strategic issues in the intelligence community, and criminal justice interrogation. These are actually governed by three different legal codes. In institutions like the Criminal Investigative Task Force, which was formed in 2002 in the Department of Defense, these three have actually become amalgamated into interesting and often conflictual ways. And I've talked to some of the warrant officers who were involved in the formation of the CIDF, and what they can tell you is that the people doing military and criminal justice interrogation often got into huge fights with each other, as they got into fights with people in the FBI. And in the ACLU documentation, you can see these institutional battles playing out as people are negotiating amongst each other based on their institutional traditions, what constitutes appropriate and legal interrogation for counterterrorism. This brings me to my second point. Within this amalgamation, we are seeing an evolution of interrogation methods. And this we might think of as the problem of culture in interrogation, or how culture talk, what Mahmoud and Mandani calls culture talk, is making itself present in this emerging set of practices around interrogation. There is an explicit focus in culture and interrogation. The interrogators I've spoken to are interested in using cultural knowledge to leverage suspects' willingness to share information in a way that they perceive as more ethical, professional, and humane than waterboarding, and they'll tell you that very strongly. They are pursuing culturally informed interrogation in ways that they feel nobody else has gone before, and this is really a hallmark of this new form of interrogation. And the third way that we might think about interrogation is as a cultural transfer, a kind of a transnational encounter that brings people from worlds that are radically different into direct conflict or communication with each other in a highly conflictual setting. Just as we know that interrogation is deeply unnerving for the people being interrogated, there's evidence from the firsthand accounts of interrogators that they find this whole encounter similarly unnerving and are frantically searching for ways to make sense of what's happening as they're in the interrogation encounter. In this regard, one small section of the ACLU's torture FOIA library, which I write about extensively in my chapter, is particularly interesting, and this is a small collection of 60 transcriptions of interrogation encounters, which I'm happy to share with anybody, in which you can see these very complex dynamics about exchanges of identity playing out in the interrogation encounter. And what's fascinating about this is that, as Richard Leo, the legal scholar who writes so much about interrogation, points out, the goal of interrogation is not necessarily to determine the truth, but it is instead about the act of elicitation and joint shaping of a narrative of truth, which may or may not be based in actual fact, and which creates huge problems for prosecutors. In closing, I wanted to say that the government's own documents on interrogation, detention, and torture in the global war on terror reveal a complicated, contradictory space of operations. In reviewing these documents and interviewing interrogators, one gets flashes of the lived experiences of individuals caught in the global war on terror. The themes and stories and accounts move and conflict and speak to and across each other, and often read head-on into each other. Interrogation in the global war on terror is a space in which the truth of suffering is brutally apparent, at the same time that the truth of explaining how that suffering comes about, what is really happening here, is deeply elusive. This is neither an easy or comfortable space, and I think it begs for the kind of critical sensibility that anthropology brings when done at its best. Thank you. So I think we have some time now for questions. I'm not entirely sure how much, and I know we have people with microphones. This is being podcast, if any of you are sensitive about that. There's a microphone, and in one session I was in, the microphone was very confusing because it didn't amplify your voice. All it does is catch your voice for the podcast. So what I would ask that you do is enunciate, as my Catholic mother would say, so that we can all hear your questions, and but you'll also be holding something. So, oh, and there's our microphone. Questions? Maybe the people who presented would come up here. It'd be Danny and Eyal and Anne. I won't be presenting for Anne or answering questions for Anne. Yes, ma'am.
My name is Emily Levitt. I did my research in Afghanistan, and a lot of cultural questions have come up in my mind since I do medical anthropology type work. And I may come up with some more specific questions relating to your specific papers, but I'm curious to know, as you've studied the security and military communities, is anyone aware of the degree to which anthropologists are able to or are prevented from influencing our national policies? I find it particularly appalling when we have women in formal positions showing up in Afghanistan in skirts, for example, completely losing all legitimacy before they open their mouth. There's just small things like that. So I'm curious to know if anyone's aware of the role that anthropologists can have in our foreign policy, because it seems that they're not being listened to if they're present and trying to be heard. The second is anyone exploring the sociology or the anthropology, sorry for mixing terms, the anthropology of how the TV show 24 is impacting our popular culture on the issue of torture. I started watching that when I was in Kabul in a sort of addicted way until I realized after the Virginia Tech massacre that I'm becoming totally desensitized to this, and what am I watching? It's a very exciting show in some levels, but very disturbing in others. And so I'm just curious to know, that I think was shaping a lot of public opinion about torture. So maybe if you've thought at all about that, or if you've been watching that and studying the content of that show specifically.
So the first question was an observation about whether or not anthropologists are having an impact on policy and on the way I think that people representing the United States in an official capacity are presenting themselves or comporting themselves in Afghanistan, specifically where you've worked, but this would also be in other cultural settings. I can't answer that. Somebody in the audience may be able to. I can tell you that I do know that the military, and I actually don't work with the military. In a singularly cheerful career, I've studied nuclear weapons designers, missile defense experts, and intelligence analysts, and now interrogators. But I actually haven't done anything with the military on that particular issue, and I don't know if you guys have. So, Jessica back there has a...
I'm not quite sure what you mean about influence on national policy, but there certainly are anthropologists in various offices within the Defense Department who are involved in planning efforts, who are involved in, I mean, I've done some of this, who are involved in doctrine preparation, who are involved, again, as many of us here, who are involved in teaching the military, who then themselves make decisions. So that's sort of an indirect way, but I think a very powerful way. So I would say, I mean, I guess I'm not quite sure how to answer that question other than to say I think there is an increasing influence of an anthropological perspective in policy and operational type decisions.
So I'll take the 24 question. I saw David Price smiling about this too, because we've actually talked about this. So I don't know if you know this, but the producers of 24 got called on the carpet for exactly this. And in his book, Tony Lagaranis, who wrote Fira Parsh, which is a firsthand account, he points to Mark Bowden's article, The Dark Art of Interrogation, which appeared in The Atlantic, the TV show 24, and then a host of other things that, like, I mean, so to step back a bit, the dispersion, this is something else I write a bit about in the chapter, the dispersion of torture practices in Iraq from Guantanamo to from Afghanistan to Guantanamo, back and forth and then into Iraq, is actually a really complex question. And I don't think there's any doubt that soldiers were watching 24. In fact, Lagaranis talks about it. What I think is interesting about that is that it put the producers of the TV show 24 into a position analogous of Rafael Patai's estate, his daughter Daphne. I actually spoke with her, and she said, you know, we're kind of like the producers of 24. It's like my dad's book and 24 have been causing torture in Abu Ghraib. What I find, I don't think there's any doubt that images play a huge role in shaping how people view what is and is not acceptable. And I'm not well placed to speak on this because I don't have a television, but I do think there's plenty of research on images. In fact, Caroline Nordstrom and Robert Rubenstein and I were talking about this yesterday in relation to something else. And to the extent I think that those images reinforce the idea that it is okay or sexy to treat people this way, it certainly gives measure. And I do know soldiers, I've heard interrogators were watching it. So, question?
This is a question directed in part to Ayel Ben-Ari, but also you, Danny, I think. In reflecting on the differences of American and other perceptions of studies that are done in relationship to security forces, to military, I wonder if you could reflect a little bit on the nature of the national engagement of anthropologists, say in Israel in particular, I'm thinking about right now, in their own military service, which is quite distinct from the figures that I've seen in the sort of generation of anthropologists, especially who are under 50 years old in the United States. In terms of a couple different issues, both the distance you have from the study, the subject, and also how access is mediated through the fact that perhaps you, as you mentioned, you were an infantry officer for 22 years in the reserve, and you are under military oath, and how that played into the access that you might have had, and other issues that you can reflect on.
This raises a whole set of questions, but I'll answer you telegraphically. First of all, there are not many anthropologists of the military in Israel. Most of the work has been carried out by sociologists and psychologists, political scientists, and so on. There are probably, including my students, maybe 7 or 8 of us. All have undergone military service. As you know, it's compulsory. It's conscription for men 3 years, women roughly 2 years, which basically means that I would say the vast majority of social scientists in general and anthropologists in particular know something about the military, either through their own experience or through relatives, friends, students, among our student body, for example. Certainly 90% of Jewish students have gone through military service, which is roughly about 80% of the student body. So it's something which is very much part of society. In terms of access, I think you have to understand something about Israeli society, and you'll pardon me if I'll tell you a little story which I told over lunch today. I taught in Singapore, and very often when I hand out the syllabus to my intro to anthropology course, I say very innocently, people ask me about the difference between Israeli culture and Singaporean culture, and I'll tell you, or I'll give you an example of a reading list. In Singapore, when you give out a reading list, it's a signal to start reading, right? Reading list. In Israel, it's a signal to start negotiating. Have pity on us, and it's in English, and so on. There's something about Israeli culture which is, and I think it's a Mediterranean or North African kind of thing, where things are open to negotiation. So that access within the military as well is much more negotiable than I would hazard to guess than it is here. And so that when I started doing research on my own unit, I let the commander know and everybody, that all the authorities that I could know, that I was doing research. It was much less of a formal mechanism by which one would go to the Israeli military censor and ask for permission and so on. In research where I have received funding from the military, I've gone through the formal channels. My students as well, when they have written seminar papers based on interviews with former soldiers, it's very easy to gain access to people who served in the past or to reservists. And people are very willing to talk or to open up and so on. And I know of no problem that any Israeli researcher has encountered in terms of this kind of access to people through the reserve duty or people talking about their experiences as conscripts. Danny?
Actually, I just have one quick thought to add, which is that the the work that I did was very much with kind of rank-and-file West African militia fighters. So it kind of came from that perspective. And your question made me think about if you were going to do a more kind of institutional perspective on the kind of outsourcing I'm talking about, you'd have to negotiate two different bodies that are actually not the U.S. military. One would be the security contractors and private companies that end up doing a lot of the training and funneling the materials. So it'd be DynCorp, it'd be PAE. And in a way, it seems like the way you would gain access to that is much more how you would gain access to any private multinational corporation as opposed to thinking about the military per se, which is a little terrifying, actually. The other is that, and this is, I think, an important point, is in, at least working in Africa, you would increasingly also have to deal with the militaries and bureaucratic structures of African states themselves. You know, a lot of the training is going through, for example, the Nigerian military, which is an incredibly closed shop. It's very hard to get access to that. So I guess what I'm saying is the kind of work that I'm envisioning one would do from, again, sort of looking at the more institutional side of it, I think is becoming vastly more complicated by the way in which this sorts of labor is being outsourced.
Hi. Sorry, I'll try to be loud, but let me know if you can't hear me. It's weird that this doesn't amplify you. I'm not really sure what my question is. Mine is more of a comment to Dr. Benary's discussion. I guess I take contention with the way that you articulate specifically Hugh Gustafson's article in the Annual Review. I don't think that the point of that, and just my experience in reading his work and the work of Catherine Lutz and others that you talk about, is that he's distinguishing between those who are virtuous and those who are polluted, but rather looking at those who are open to their work being a critique and not being censored by those that they're doing work with, but at the same time allowing for the humanizing of all people involved. I think in my experience of reading their work that, you know, Catherine Lutz and Hugh Gustafson specifically do a great job of trying to break down the barriers that maybe more progressive activists might have in dehumanizing, for example, nuclear scientists or people that are working for the military. And so I'm not really sure my question has been maybe just a reaction from you. I don't think that they're saying necessarily that they're more virtuous, but rather that they don't hold their work hostage to those people that they're studying. They're rather they're open for an analysis, whatever that analysis may be, and including trying to humanize all people involved.
I actually want to respond to that. I know Hugh very well. So there was actually one book, John Hawkins. I don't know if you've read John Hawkins' work on military families, where I really took I actually tend to agree a little bit with y'all on this, and it's not because I work for the National Security State. Hugh and I are good friends, and we tend to see eye to eye on most things. In this case, though, I actually do not see eye to eye with him, and the specific reason was the way that he treated John Hawkins' work, which is one of the most humanizing, simultaneously humanizing and critical assessments of the way that the military deals, of the way that military dynamics impact families and impact the identity and the psychological health of soldiers. And it was hardly held hostage to any of the institutions for which John has worked and with which he has worked. And yet it was lumped into this category of this kind of uncritical thinking to the point where I was profoundly irritated by it, knowing John and having read the book several times and thinking it was an absolutely brilliant piece of scholarship. The irony in that is that Hugh has a whole chapter, if you've read Nuclear Rights, on the impact of secrecy on family dynamics and the way that husbands and wives or spouses begin to keep maintain distances around the issue of work. And the irony is that John Hawkins has a similar chapter in his book, and in many ways his book mirrors what Hugh is talking about. And so the way that Hugh, I think, in that article kind of dichotomizes this is really problematic in the way that he kind of lumps this together. And I've told him I don't think he thought through it. So.
Your comment is well taken, and I think he is an extraordinary scholar. It wasn't an attack on his work. What did get me irritated is the title, Anthropology in the Military. It's only about the U.S. There have been a host of anthropologists in Turkey, former Yugoslavia, the Czech Republic, all in, and including Hawkins' work on the U.S., enabled by the military, some of them funded by the military, and actually not hostage, actually hugely critical. And in the way he dichotomizes things, I felt there was an underlying political agenda, And I would have accepted his contentions much more if he would have been really clear about his political agenda, as he is in the Network for Concerned Anthropologists. So if we're talking about reflexive anthropology, which is a mark of American anthropology at least since the 1980s, some of it devolving into naval anthropology, not in the armed forces sense of naval, if you take it seriously, be clear about your politics as well. That was my problem with that specific article.
I wanted to ask Dr. Benary about, he's kind of alluded to his negotiation process, which he's already said is very Israeli, with the military and having to make compromises in order to gain access. I wonder if he would elucidate a little bit on that as to what compromises he had to make and which compromises he deemed as unacceptable to make and therefore turned down access opportunities.
Very briefly, three projects. One about the checkpoints, where the military approached me in order to carry out a project to improve the processing of Palestinians through checkpoints. And I was adamant and I was not willing to accept the military limitation. I said, we have to interview Palestinians if we want to understand the checkpoints. They did not agree. And I said, okay, I'm leaving the project. No questions asked. In the end, they agreed. That was an example of a line which I would not cross. Two other projects. One, with colleagues, I have a book coming out on the Israeli military in the second intifada. It's coming out with SUNY Press. Since this is America, this is your advertising part of television. It went through the censorship. The censor cut out a chapter on checkpoints, a different chapter, which was enabled by the military and so on. We were willing to accept that because we have another chapter which is being published, which is about infringement of human rights by the Israeli military, human rights of the Palestinians and so on. With my colleagues, we talked about it. We thought of giving up the whole project and so on. We were willing to accept the cancellation of one and not the other. Third project is with a colleague and friend named Edna Lomsky-Feder. We've been undertaking a project on managing diversity in the Israeli military, which is actually about the way the Israeli military reproduces inequality. And it's related to a question I was asked before. The Israeli military is not homogenous. And I think Robert Rubenstein will speak about this later. And there are people you can work with, coalition partners and so on. In the context of Israel, reproducing inequality by the Israeli military is much more explosive than questions about infringement of Palestinian human rights. Much more politically problematic. And with my colleague, with Edna, we decided that because of potential censorship, along with interviewing people within the military, we would interview ourselves and through our students, people outside the military, so that we would have sources we could use for writing articles and books and so on if the military censors our work. It's these kinds of considerations which we have to take into account when we are enabled by the military.
We are apparently at time. I guess we have one more question. I hate to cut this off. We will be having more questions later. We have a break for a bit now, and we will reconvene in I don't know how many minutes. 10 minutes, I guess. All right. Thank you so much.